Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
Welcome to our 21st episode of Serious Privacy. There is no better way to celebrate 21 than to return to our roots and have a kitchen table conversation with our own Paul Breitbart. And I'm excited to do the introduction this week, which probably surprises you not to hear Paul's wonderfully mellow voice bringing you into the session. We limited it to one topic. He's going to discuss his favorite privacy topic. Do you think he'll go for two topics like Kay did? Does he have one overwhelming favorite issue in privacy? With Paul's background with the data protection authorities, he has much more of a legally scholar slant, so this should be a very interesting treasure hunt to find out what resonates more with Paul. My name is Kay Royal.
And I'm Paul Breitbart, and welcome to Serious Privacy.
Awesome. Okay, Paul, that's going to be the question. What is your favorite privacy topic? I really am burning to know, because I'm sure my two surprised you.
So, Kay, before I answer your question, let me start with the unexpected question for you. Because
role reversal.
This time, it is then your unexpected question to answer. What's for dinner tonight?
It is Friday night, so we will probably cheat and order pizza. And my pizza options are very limited because I'm allergic to gluten. But there is a local, well, most of the pizzerias now offer the cauliflower crust pizza. But I'm also very picky about my toppings. I don't do mega or supreme or anything like that. It's usually bacon and cheese.
Sounds like a good dinner for Friday nights.
And you, what's for dinner for you?
I have no idea. It will be a surprise dinner.
That's not an answer. You're cheating.
No, it's not. I'm going out to dinner with friends. Mm. It's a dinner and dance. We have bought these tickets well before Corona and
ballet.
Have been living in limbo in hope that it would be able to go on. It is outside. The weather is nice, so it will take place. But the dinner itself is a surprise. It's at a place called Greens in the Park, which means that they cook everything out of their vegetable garden.
Oh.
But that's about all I know. And then there will be 12 ballet solos throughout the night.
That is fantastic. You do know that Arizona's rate of COVID infection is like the highest in the world right now.
Yes, I read things about that.
Yes. We had a rally this week for the president, and neither the president nor the governor wore masks, which, you know, President Trump doesn't like wearing masks. I thought Governor Ducey did, though, but he didn't. I was not at the rally, but I saw pictures of it, and very few people were wearing masks. So I anticipate that our rate of infection is going to go up even more over the next 2 weeks.
I can't imagine that.
Yay. Okay, wonderful. All right, now let's get to the privacy topic. What is your favorite privacy topic? I really am dying to know.
If I only can pick one, then it probably will be government surveillance.
Government surveillance. Now, are you talking officially government surveillance for things like COVID, or are you talking black ops, or are you talking about monitoring the general public?
All of the above.
Nice. Give me more about that. Why?
Because it is a topic that is at the crossroads of politics, which I love, as you may know, of privacy and data protection, of fundamental rights more in general, of very complex legal discussions, and also how countries relate to each other, the international diplomacy. So like your topic last week, it has lots of angles that you can approach the government surveillance issue from. And it all started for me in the summer of, I think, 2013. I mentioned it before, the Washington Post articles on Top Secret America, when I spent probably most of the summer analyzing all those articles that the Washington Post came out with, and analyzing them from a data protection perspective, from an EU data protection perspective. What is going on in the United States, and how does this impact what we are doing here in the EU and any possible data transfers to the United States? And then came Edward Snowden.
Yes.
And I got to dive in even further. And then came the Schrems 1 decision, and I got to dive in again.
Ow.
So, and now Schrems 2 in a couple of weeks. We'll have a special episode on that as well. But all those summers and winters, to some extent, working on these issues made me realize how much we don't know of what is going on, what our governments are doing and trying to know about us. And of course, when you talk about government surveillance in general, the assumption is that you are speaking about the security and intelligence services looking at what citizens of foreign countries are doing, either in your own country or abroad, and to get national security related or national economy related information that could then be used. But it is also, for example, here in the Netherlands, what the tax authorities are doing. They have some sort of a catch-all provision in the tax legislation that, at least according to their claim, allows them to request copies of any database that the government maintains, whether that is the automated number plate recognition that they could then use to verify whether the appropriate taxes have been paid for company cars, to more generic discussions, to the cameras above highways to see, again, to verify all those cars, looking at phone records and also the phone location data to be able to find out where people were sleeping, to see if they are not getting government funding while not sleeping in their own beds, and when so trying to mislead Social Security. So all kinds of government surveillance. And
what parts of it do you think are good?
I do understand that governments want to take a look at misuse of government funds, and that they want to try to keep the nation secure and protect their citizens against harm. I think that is important. But the way it is done, that is concerning to me.
And I know that the Snowden really made a big scandal over the United States, which frankly couldn't really have surprised people who are in this area or study this area. But do you think it was unfair that all of the focus landed on the United States when more likely than not every other country was doing just about the same thing?
Yes and no. Let me start with the no, because I thought to a large extent it was fair, because you would expect that there is a difference between how your allies behave and how your opponents behave.
That is true.
And the scale of the government surveillance perpetrated by the United States government under both Democratic and Republican presidents, so the political preferences don't make any difference here, was so vast and so intransparent and so secretive that I think it rightly shocked the world.
Yeah.
Well, I do believe that every single government
shocked the world, or shocked Europe?
No, shocked the world. Shocked the world. I think also outside of Europe, there were lots of concerns raised about the scale of government surveillance. It shocked Europe more, probably, because of our fundamental rights approach to personal data. And the impact has certainly been bigger here in Europe than in other jurisdictions. But I do think there was a wider shock, similar to the shock of the disclosure of the diplomatic cables by WikiLeaks that preceded all of this. That is also part of that whole discussion. What can you disclose? What can whistleblowers disclose? What are the boundaries? What are the limits of what governments should do, could do, may need to do? So to that extent, yes, I think it was a shock. Do all governments do similar things? Yes, of course. national security is something that every government is responsible for. And that is also part of the criticism that I have on my own government and on the European member states. If you look at the intricacies of the European treaties, national security is not a topic that falls within the remit of legislation of the European Union, because national security is something that belongs to the member states,
right,
according to the treaty. However, counterterrorism is something that has been regulated by the European Union since 9/11, and especially since the follow-up attacks in London and Madrid in 2004 and 2005. And nobody can explain why counterterrorism would qualify just as a criminal law topic or a serious criminal law topic and not as national security.
Interesting.
So in my view, by legislating on counterterrorism issues, the European Union has de facto included national security in their legislative remit as well.
Yeah.
And that also means that from a data protection perspective, the European Union should be able to legislate on what security services can and cannot do with data of other European member states, how this should impact third country assessments, things like that. I do believe that that should be taken into account, because to some extent it's very hypocrite that we say to the United States, we don't like it, that any data that we transfer to you might end up with the NSA, the FBI, the CIA, or any of the other security services.
Or the ones we may not know
about. While the other way around, we make no problem about it.
Yeah.
And we don't put any restrictions on our security services. That is a bit unfair, but that is the reality of the law. At the same time, our courts have also been very clear about what is and isn't allowed from a national security perspective. And because of the fundamental rights approach that we take, whether that is the Council of Europe Convention on Fundamental Rights or the EU Charter on Fundamental Rights, in both situations, all those rights are attributed to mankind, to humankind, and not to people coming from a specific jurisdiction.
Right.
Whereas in the United States, as we all know, there is a distinction being made between U.S. persons and non-U.S. persons, or anybody not having a U.S. passport or an habitual place of residence in the United States just isn't as protected as people who have and who do.
Right. And we know that there are countries whose government surveillance is even more intrusive than the United mm-hmm. States. So do you have any thoughts? And I'll just randomly bring one to mind, China. That
very random.
Very random, right? Just kind of popped into my head. But it's interesting because I have some Chinese friends, and they've told me that the government is not truly surveilling its population the way countries outside China seem to think they're doing. And that, in particular, the social score is the one that gets me, which I understand. It's government surveillance, maybe not quite at the level of counterterrorism, but really, ultimately, it feeds into that as well. Any thoughts on that system?
Oh, yeah, many.
Let's keep it PC so we don't have to put a disclaimer. May not be appropriate for young audiences.
Not again, you want to say.
I have a thought on that too, by the way.
Let me see. No, in general, I think the social credit system is very scary. Obviously, for anybody who has seen it, it reminds very much of a Black Mirror episode that became reality way too quickly. If you haven't seen it, we'll link to it in the show notes.
I've heard about it, yes.
It's very scary. But the social credit system, for me, is a form of government surveillance. I also do understand that a lot of people in and from China consider that differently, because the cultural approach is also quite different.
Right.
They are very much brought up in the tradition that the government is there to take care of you, to protect you, but in able to allow them to do that, they also need to know about you, about who you are, what you do, in order to actually be able to take care of you.
The difference between a big brother approach and a loving father approach.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comparison. And I think if we look at the social credit system with our Western mindset, not having been brought up in the full Chinese cultural tradition. And for me, then, in addition with the whole fundamental rights that have been drilled into my head since day one in law school, and probably even before that, you do get probably a distorted view of how the Chinese see it,
right,
and what the intentions of the government are.
Everything has our bias applied to it.
Yes, of course. And I think to a large extent, if you try to look at it objectively, or as objective as I can, I do think that there are elements in the social credit system that are really intended to improve society. Because you are also nudged to doing the right things, to behave yourself in traffic, to go visit your parents.
Or to be for jaywalking.
Well, you know, there are things that I like less, but I mean, the encouragement to be a bit nicer in society,
right,
all in general, I do think that is a laudable approach. I don't like the way they have implemented it, but that we could all be a bit more friendly and respectable towards each other instead of always being angry,
right,
might actually be nice.
There is a theory out, or there was a study done that showed that people were more honest when they felt they were being watched. And this was proven out even if there was just, you know, a picture with a face with eyes on it as a brochure right there on the counter in, say, like a Superstop kind of store. Like a corner grocery mart with gasoline and everything. And that people were more honest if they felt they were being watched. I kind of took that to extremes and posted a 6-foot set of eyes on the wall of one of my offices. Don't know that I disproved or proved the theory. But this also feeds into what we hear a lot of police complain about body cams. That wearing body cams impacts the way they do their jobs. Now, it seems like here in the U.S., it doesn't seem to be impacting the way they do their job at all, but that body cams are interfering with how they perform because they feel like they're always being watched. I'm not sure I think that's a bad thing. Your thoughts on body cams?
I think it's very ironic that the police is complaining about being watched where they are the biggest proponents of having surveillance cameras for their citizens everywhere else. Oops. It's cynical.
Not the local police that have cameras watching everyone else.
Well, that depends on where you are.
Well, that's true.
In the Netherlands, the cameras are often run by the police. And it's not just the police wearing body cams. Also, our local security personnel and ticket checkers in trains and...
Really?
The conductors and yeah, everybody.
I did not know that.
Yeah, also for security purposes.
You know, I want to point out, you have not once during this podcast heard me go, "Oh, that's fantastic."
True, true. So no, it's for me all of this invisible, more or less, surveillance indeed has an impact on who we are and what we do, and this is also what, in the words of the European Court, causes a chilling effect. But it also causes limitations to people becoming who they want to be. Because if you are brought up in a state of fear, that you are not able to express yourself freely because you are always being watched and you are always mindful of the impact on anything you do, then how can you develop freely into the human being that you are supposed to become, or that you may want to become? You are always held back and can never make a mistake. How do you learn from your mistakes?
Right.
People need to make mistakes.
They do. And are your body cams over their own 24/7, like the whole time someone's on the job they're on, or do they affirmatively have to turn them on and off?
They have to turn them on and off.
Okay.
And there is a visual indicator that the camera is on.
Okay.
But I've also encountered already situations where somebody came to check my ticket on a train and the camera was on.
Got it. The reason I was asking is because it feeds into what you were just saying about how can people learn and make mistakes if they're, you know, always being watched. And if the cameras are running 24/7, people tend to forget they're there. Eventually you become... Oh, what do you call it? Not desensitized. You become desensitized to the cameras being on and you act as your normal self. But if the cameras affirmatively have to be turned on and off, then you're not allowed that opportunity of desensitization.
I don't fully agree.
Detention or the not being desensitized?
The not being desensitized. I think it's if you know that you are always under observation, that will impact your behavior. If anything you do can always come back to you, and especially if it is also happening, that indeed follow-up is given to what is being recorded, being seen, that will have an impact. And there are cameras now everywhere, whether it is above the highway to check speeds or to check traffic jams or to indeed use the ANPR cameras, the automated number plate recognition for, I don't know, congestion charges in big cities or
congestion
to like a toll system that you need to pay in order to get into city centers during rush hour, during the day, like an environmental zone. To enter London, the city of London, by car, I think by now you pay about £10 a day.
And there's no like toll booth or big thing you pass under that says toll charge now.
No, there is just a camera on the ring roads, and that's linked to your license plate.
Now, the same that sounds in interesting that we don't have that amount of cameras here. This is not something the United States is accustomed to. We don't have cameras mounted on all the streets. As a matter of fact, there are some cities that stand out because they've implemented some camera systems, like Chicago, San Francisco, things like that. But they stand out because this isn't common across the United States. For states or for cities or counties that actually have toll systems, most of them are still on the old system of having toll booths. And even now, if they have the speed tolls that you can skip around the booths and go through, it's still the entire whole elaborate setup that you can tear where it is. We're not accustomed to having cameras here. And where we do have them, they are very much well known that the government is taking this extra step, and there's lots of debate and discussion over it and everything. So I will say it's interesting that given, and this is something that comes up in the law class I teach all the time too, given the difference between the fundamental right to privacy in Europe and the United States, Europe has much more mass surveillance than the United States does that we know of.
We have public sector mass surveillance run by government.
Right.
You have much more private sector mass surveillance that is done on behalf of government.
Right. So, and that kind of, it's interesting in that dichotomy, because of course, if the government was doing mass surveillance that we didn't know of, we wouldn't know of it. But eventually everything here in the United States hits the sheets anyway. But I think it is interesting. So I know one of them is that in the GDPR, there is that element under high-risk data where mass surveillance of a public area is considered one of the high-risk areas. That element in itself makes no sense to most people here in the U.S.
No, I do understand that. But here it does, because there is so much monitoring of public spaces going on. And also of private spaces, by the way, because almost every office building nowadays has CCTV cameras as well. So from the GDPR perspective, I'm happy that part is there. At least it provides a bit of a threshold before surveillance can be implemented. At least that's the hope.
Right.
But yeah, it's a concern.
That's not something that is very common in the U.S. to be accustomed to there being mass surveillance of public areas.
But no, maybe not. I must say that I've never really paid attention to cameras in the streets while in the U.S. and will do so the next time that I can come across. But it's about more than just the cameras. What probably surprised me most of all the Snowden revelations.
Oh, this ought to be interesting.
The fact that there is a secret court with secret judgments, the FISA court.
Yeah.
That is something that goes so much against everything I learned in law school, that everybody should know what the law is all about, that you should have rights of redress, that you should be able to defend yourself when accused of something. And to just have a court that sits without hearing from both parties, issues rulings that are kept secret, issues guidelines that are kept secret. How are you supposed to know what to do if you are not able to read the law.
Well, that is true. And the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court came about in 1976. It came because of, again, some FBI documents that were released to the public in 1971. And I think it was a senator, I'm looking it up here, Senator Frank Church started investigating it. It was actually called the Church Committees. And that committee was investigating abuses, government abuses especially. And so following that, they created a Committee on Intelligence, which later became or was joined by the FISA. And they worked to limit the power of the agencies, ensuring that the surveillance fell within the rules of the law. Now, I'm not sure how successful they were, but but that was interesting. So it is a secret court with secret judgments, but actually you can get request information from FISA requests, but it is supposed to regulate the government, and that's why here in the U.S. inherently they keep it quiet, is so information about our government activities aren't released to foreign powers in order, you know, that would open up a vulnerability. That to us makes sense to us.
But when you say that you can request information from the FISA court, you can request it. I can't,
right?
Because I have no standing being a non-U.S. person.
Right, exactly. But I will say what doesn't make sense to people who actually look into it was the USA Patriot Act that was passed after 9/11 that very, very intrusive and very, very broad. And I know it was passed quickly. I know the actions that the entire world took after 9/11 based on the activities were very strong and immediately and were there for a purpose. But the USA Patriot Act went a little further than probably what it should have done. And I think it would even surprise a lot of people in the United States to realize how far the Patriot Act went, because, you know, I'm sure this is the same way in Europe. Most of us don't buckle down and actually read the laws. We just listen, unfortunately, to what social media tells us the law says.
Yeah, and what you should be angry about.
Exactly. And if we're not angry about it, there's enough bots out there. If you got 30,000 bots telling you what to be angry about, you weren't going to be angry about it. But now you should, because you're seeing it everywhere.
So if everybody is angry, then probably you should be angry too.
And nobody believes that it's bots, but we all know it's bots.
Maybe I should start writing some bots and also get the U.S. to get angry, for example, about the U.S. Cloud Act, which was also rushed through in response to a court case where the U.S. were not given what they wanted, the Microsoft Ireland warrant case. Interesting piece of case law, because it is about the clash of jurisdictions, and that's what makes all of these surveillance issues so fascinating for me. It's about a clash of jurisdictions.
Oh, yeah.
And there is no real solution for a clash of jurisdictions, because it will always be, if you go with one, then the other, then you breach the other law, and vice versa. But in the Microsoft Ireland warrant case, the U.S. government subpoenaed information from Microsoft on a suspect of a serious crime or a terrorist offense, and that information was stored on servers in Ireland. And Microsoft held, correctly in my view, that under EU law, they needed a legal basis to transfer that personal data from Ireland to the United States, and they couldn't, because there was no legal basis to do so. The only way to do that was through a mutual legal assistance procedure, which is intended for situations like this. But the U.S. government thought that that would be too lengthy and too complex to do. So instead of paying more attention to the whole discussion on how to improve mutual legal assistance, they just designed a way to get around it and force companies headquartered in the U.S. to hand over the information wherever in the world it was stored,
right,
and notwithstanding any other legislation, which from the strict U.S. perspective is understandable and a quick solution. But my internationalist mind thinks, well, you better try and solve these things at a global level, on a diplomatic level, to make sure that also in the future we have ways in which we can exchange this valuable information. Because I don't think that any judge would deny the U.S. the right to get information on a potential criminal or terrorist if it is asked for in the right way.
I agree. The Cloud Act, unfortunately, was just one of the many activities taken in the environment in the United States in more recent years that perhaps many of the public are unaware of, or it just seems to be almost exhaustion of the government taking actions that if we were more aware of, or those that do pay attention to, would vastly disagree with. But I have to tell you, many of us here, and I speak for myself and many people I talk to, are just under exhaustion of government activities. It's almost, yes, as someone said, the government could literally do something like shoot people in the middle of Fifth Avenue in New York and nobody would care. And I'm not talking about things that are going on in the past few months on the race relations, just more of some statements that have been made from some political figures. And I'm not trying to push political agenda here, more of the privacy to explain that some of this is merely because we're just in a very different political climate than many of us who study law are accustomed to being in.
Yeah.
Good or bad.
And let me be fair, because I'm not just criticizing the United States. I am, but not just the United States.
Well, thank you, but it's okay. We're accustomed to it too.
I know, but still. Also, my own government has lots to be sorry for.
Yeah.
Because, what is it, about three years ago, the Dutch government also proposed a new law on the intelligence and security services that, in my view, goes way beyond what is allowed under our fundamental rights agreements internationally. I campaigned against that law because there was a referendum at the time, and I'm pretty much against referenda, and in this case I made an exception. I campaigned against the law. I wrote a series of articles as well because I didn't like this law. And just to give one example, the Dutch security services are allowed to monitor internet and telecommunications lines. And as people may not be aware, one of the largest internet exchanges in the world is the Internet Exchange in Amsterdam, which means that a lot of the global internet traffic is also routed via Amsterdam,
okay,
which then in turn could be surveilled by the Dutch security services. And they are allowed to share data with security services in third countries, following a form of an adequacy assessment to find out if those security services are treating the information that they receive in a decent way. But what they are also allowed to do is to share information that has not been analyzed yet by the Dutch services with foreign services. They also need to stick to, for example, taking out sensitive personal information. That is a rule under the law, but they are allowed to share information before they have made that assessment, which means that it's perfectly possible that the Dutch security services catch information online in bulk, and before they have done the full analysis, share that data set because they consider it to be important with the security services in France or in Australia or wherever, including all kinds of data that they were not allowed to process strictly here on Dutch soil. And that might also create some sort of backdoor, because then they could get it handed back from the foreign services again as information that they discovered. So that's just one of the examples. But the referendum was a clear no. The government, a majority of the people here in the Netherlands said this law should not happen. The government decided to ignore the referendum because it wasn't binding. And any changes that were promised are still pending in Parliament, which means that the law has been in force for about 3 years. It has been evaluated. The supervisory authorities on the security and intelligence services have said it doesn't function well. There is way more information going through the services. It's not well motivated what they are collecting. And at the same time, it's all happening.
Well, that actually reminds me of the point I thought earlier when you were talking about mass surveillance, is the Carpenter case that came down through our United States Supreme Court back in 2018, that a lot of us were just waiting with bated breath to see what this case was. And it was interesting because it was based under our third party doctrine, where you can get information from a third party, not a government, because people voluntarily give their information to a telecommunications carrier. So therefore, it's not protected. You gave it up. You waived your right of privacy. And so we were waiting for this decision to come down because historically our government had ruled that third party doctrine was protected, that even tracking cell phones was allowed because it's the same thing as being out in the public view, same that your cameras in Europe. If you're out in the public, you have no expectation of privacy. So tracking someone electronically is the same thing as tracking them in person, completely allowed. You have no expectation of privacy with that. But it was interesting because in the Carpenter case, they finally came to a decision. And for legal scholars on listening to the podcast, please forgive me if I muck this up in complete legal technical terms. But essentially saying that, yeah, you can monitor someone electronically by tracking their cell phone. It's the same thing as tracking them in person. But you're not going to track someone in person 24/7 for hundreds of days. So that's actually true. Unreasonable to say it's the same thing as tracking someone in person. And so they didn't go as far as I think that privacy people would like to have, but it went a lot further than we were afraid they would. So it was really good. It was a good thing. And that's what I was thinking about the mass surveillance is the telecommunications. So I'm really glad you brought that back up. I think every country has it. I just frankly, and as we come to a close, I'll say I think frankly that our digital age, the capability of our technology, the sheer massiveness of the technology, and the fact that the world is a smaller place because of the technology, that it's just really, really difficult to try to maintain or enforce or establish true control mm-hmm. from government surveillance when there's just so much of it you can't get. I mean, there's just so much opportunity there. How can you possibly not do it?
True.
I wish they wouldn't in some cases. I'm with you. I think it's intrusive in many cases and uncontrolled in a lot of cases. But it's just... this is something that our forefathers, our ancestors, people in our own generations would never have imagined 50 years ago.
No, I agree. It's especially with telecommunications, it's become very hard to stay unobserved. And again, that is part of case law of the European courts in a number of cases by now on the retention of telecommunications data. And also there, the court refers to the chilling effect. If you are monitored 24/7, that is a concern.
Yeah, it really is. Well, thank you. I would not have guessed that as being your topic, but I guess I could have. I had several running around in my brain as to what your favorite topic might be. And you didn't disappoint. Absolutely fascinating topic. I loved talking about
pleasure.
It with you.
It's a good setup for the episode we'll do on the Schrems II decision that comes out on 16 July. We'll try to have it out as quickly as possible after the judgment comes. So watch out for that in the 17 July weekend.
I am very, very excited about that. So again, my pleasure to be able to do the wrap up. If you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us. Should you have any questions or suggestions, if you even want to be on our show, because we welcome that. And by the way, our next show, I'm highly considering doing an open mic. I might have to bribe some friends to attend, but just opening up a Zoom call and let privacy people come in and figure out what that is. So look forward to that as well. Now that I've said it, I kind of have to do it. But please reach out to us via seriousprivacy@trustarc.com, and that's ARC for ARC, or via Twitter at Podcast Privacy. You will find Paul on Twitter as EuroPaulB, and you will find me on Twitter as Heart of Privacy. We've thoroughly enjoyed being able to share this with you. We hope you enjoyed it as well. And Paul always says goodbye for now, so I have to let him do that.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely.
TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.